This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore. Today is August 14, 2003. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room, and Mr. Montemore is in Kansas City, Missouri, and it is about 10:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. Sir, why don't we pick up where we left off? We have been discussing some specific incidents in your flying, and I'd like to describe what your typical day was like, if you could.
Okay. Are we talking about in-country?
Yes, sir, in-country.
Okay. Yeah. Typical day, we flew almost every day. Occasionally there would be a day, I guess, off in the sense that if you flew, you had to have at least, I think it was 12 hours from one flight to the next flight.
Mm-hmm.
But they would schedule in the 28 days that you were there at a particular base, flying out of that base, they would schedule probably at least a day or two or three off in that month.
Mm-hmm.
But typical day was that you had a mission. Typically, if it was to be in either an early morning or a late night
mm-hmm.
flight.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was an early morning flight, you probably would be up by 4:30 or 5, and then briefing at 5 or 5:30, and then take off just before daylight and get to your first landing field by daylight. And you had to have, because none of the landing strips, of course, had any lights in order
right.
to have any control tower.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them didn't have any contact whatsoever with the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were just sort of on your own. You had to be what's called daylight VFR, visual flying rules,
okay.
applied, and there was no air traffic control procedures to follow because there was really no radar that was set up to control the military traffic. So typical day would be you'd get up in the morning at 4:35, you'd get over there and probably take off just before daylight, get to your first landing zone probably by daylight, depending on the time of the year. That would be around 6 usually, and then
mm-hmm.
you flew till probably 2:30 or 3 and typically would have 7 or 8 different missions, landings that
mm-hmm.
you would find out about when you first went over to the operations area to get your frag, to get your schedule for
mm-hmm.
the day of which field you'd be going to and what you would be carrying into or out of those strips.
Mm-hmm.
Then somewhere along the line you would also have a trip back to a normal base where you would refuel and have any maintenance problems looked at or whatever, and then you'd go back out and finish your frag till probably around 3 or so, and you'd be done. The crew would then be free to go back to the BOQs or the housing facilities, and
mm-hmm.
typically people would get together and try to either cook out or go to the bar or
mm-hmm.
the officers' club, or each housing area would have its own facilities in terms of a bar or a meeting place, and
mm-hmm.
typically that would go till 9 or 10 o'clock at night or whatever, and then everybody would go get a few hours sleep and go do it, the same thing the next day.
Okay. What would you say was the most interesting cargo that you ever carried?
Well, I think one of the more interesting missions I had, it wasn't so much because it was a cargo, but it was what they call Class A ordnance. But the reason that it sticks out in my mind was because, I don't know if I've relayed this to you, but one time I went into Phnom Penh, Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
When I had just seen on television the president saying that nobody would be going more than 23 miles beyond the border of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
because Cambodia was not part of the war, and they thought it was kind of funny, but
mm-hmm.
really strange that I would be going way, way beyond that,
mm-hmm.
hundreds of miles into Phnom Penh that night after seeing the president saying that no Americans would be beyond the 23-mile limit, and, and I was one of them. But as far as the cargo is concerned, it's not really cargo. The one that probably paid most attention to is when we had bodies, body bags.
Right.
And I guess...
we talked about that.
Yeah. And the I guess in, aside from just plain old cargo, meaning could be mail, could be food, could be bombs, could be ammunition or whatever, but sometimes we would carry the sentry dogs. And
right.
That was, they would be, of course, in cages and all that, but it was more of an interesting mission because then you had somebody to talk to about the dogs and how they did and what they were guarding and why and how they trained them and that sort of thing. But it just really, mostly, the pilots didn't know what they were carrying, typically. There was many times that the airplanes were loaded when the pilots weren't there. There were many times that the planes were unloaded and reloaded with other stuff while the pilot's sitting in the pilot seat with the engines running. So the pilots do not get really involved in what they were carrying so much. It was the loadmaster and the ground people were trusted and had the judgment and whatever to do what needed to be done in terms of loading the equipment and or whatever the cargo happened to be. And so there were many times when we didn't even know what we carried.
I imagine there was a high amount of trust before or with the loadmaster, making sure everything was balanced, the weight was proper, everything like that.
Right, absolutely. It had to be, and because you're running those airplanes basically at the limit all the time because
right.
of their short field takeoff and landing capability, but if you don't have that loaded correctly, your margin for error is really small. So the loadmaster's got to be very, very proficient at doing their job. And I guess the other thing that happened partway when I was through my tour, at least that's when I heard about it, was there was a couple of airplanes that exploded instead of imploded. Normally if an airplane gets shot down, it will show signs of something entering through the skin of the airplane. And we lost a couple of C-130s that exploded from the outside in, or from the inside out, and so the theory was, although nobody knew because everybody died, but the theory was that when you carried a lot of passengers that were the indigenous, I mean, they were the local, the Vietnamese citizenry, that it got to be a big deal to check every place that you could when they left, because the theory was that they would leave behind a grenade or something that would, after they left, and they would hide it behind a panel. Usually they would stick it in a cup, or at least that's the theory, and I don't know if they found any of these or not, but then after the airplane would fly for a certain period of time, a jolt or a break or whatever would happen, and then that would then fall over, and the hand grenade would then become loose and free to arm itself and then explode.
Right.
And so...
Did that ever happen on your airplane?
No, not on my airplane. And we never found any evidence. I mean, we never found anything on the airplane before we took off. Now,
that,
there were
yeah.
other airplanes that did.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, that's what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there were other airplanes that did, or at least that's what I heard.
Okay.
And so...
always vigilant. You had to be.
Right, right. But we came, because of a couple of incidents... We became less casual about checking the airplane before taking off for the next mission.
How would you describe... Well, let's talk about the enemy. How would you describe the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong and the people of the United States were fighting against? What are your general impressions?
Well, very distant
right.
as a pilot. You really don't get involved in any hand-to-hand or face-to-face combat. Whatever we saw, it was only something that was thrown at us, either a grenade or a missile or a rocket or whatever, or small arms fire, mostly is what it was. But very little, I never felt any personal contact, and although I heard a lot of stories about people that were on the bases that provided services to the military, such as barbers or janitors or cooks or maintenance people or whatever. There was a lot of South Vietnamese that had access to the bases. I mean, they're huge bases. They're just big. I mean, like cities, and thousands and maybe tens of thousands of people on them. And you always heard these stories, but I never felt uncomfortable at all around any of the locals. I'm sure they must have been some of them that were not happy with us and would have preferred to have us not be there, or to be more demonstrative than that. But if it ever happened, it didn't happen to me. I mean, I didn't feel that way. And there were a lot of times when, in the middle of the night, there would start a lot of the tracers and a lot of the firing and all that around the perimeter of the base would happen. And the rumors a lot of times were, well, they shot four people and two of them were barbers, you know, at the base. And you heard those stories, whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. I know that I also heard stories that people would be what they call clear their weapons at late night. So when somebody would see tracers coming from another direction, when somebody's just clearing their weapon, taking the last few bullets out by shooting them, well, they think somebody's shooting at them, so they shoot back. And, of course, then now they think somebody's shooting at them, so then now you got a big friendly, what they call a friendly fire, and people are shooting at each other, and there's nobody there. I mean, I don't know. I hear that.
Right. Did you fly with any weaponry? Did you carry a sidearm or anything like that in the cockpit?
Well, we carried just a .38.
Okay.
The airplane itself did not have weaponry.
Right.
Although there are C-130s that do carry huge amounts of armament. But ours did not, and we each carried a survival vest with a .38. Most people were more afraid of losing or having the weapon stolen than figuring they were ever going to use it, because the way we thought about it is, if we ever got shot down, well, we're never going to, you know, probably not going to make it out anyway. And if you've got a .38 and you're surrounded by people, I mean, that's just, I mean, you wouldn't fire it anyway. I mean,
it's
silly, unless you're going to fire it yourself.
But
it's not something everybody dwelled on.
Uh-huh.
That was it was just kind of a passing joke that, hey, they gave us this gun again. Who's going to watch the guns this, you know, this day? You know, instead of thinking, well, I need this to get through the day in case I get shot down. I mean, it really wasn't, man. We just didn't think about it much.
Were you issued the weapons, or did you have them at all times?
We were issued them when we left. I was stationed at Ching Chuang Kong in Taiwan, and so they would give us each a survival vest and a gun, which we signed out individually from our personal equipment shop in Taiwan. And then when we came back 28 days later, then we would turn in that survival vest and the weapon by serial number back when we got to CCK. So we were not issued weapons in Vietnam. We already had them when we went there.
Okay.
But basically, nobody paid much attention to it.
Right. What is your impression of the Vietnamese civilians? What was your impression?
I thought that they were friendly, helpful. They were, there's not a lot of interaction. There's not, I mean, I'm sure that they were mostly uneducated and certainly not bilingual, and none of us knew nothing, anything. So
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to communicate directly except by sign language, you know, saying pointing at something or
mm-hmm.
or making a gesture that means you're going to sleep now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, try to, you know, hurry or try to leave or whatever it is. I mean, sometimes we would land at right after daybreak
mm-hmm.
and we flew fly all night. Then if you go to have breakfast and maybe a few beers or something, and then now it's noon, and you've got another mission that night at 10 o'clock. Well, I mean, you gotta go to bed sometime. You gotta
mm-hmm.
get some sleep sometime. So sometimes our schedules were such that we didn't go to bed till 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd be getting up at 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock that night to fly another night mission.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you got in the that schedule, you stayed in that schedule for a few days, and then you would get a day or so off, and then you could switch back to the day.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't go from night to day just because you didn't have enough time in between to get your mandatory crew rest of,
mm-hmm.
I think it was 12 hours, may have been 10. But anyway, there was a certain amount of time that you couldn't fly from landing to takeoff.
Right.
So, there was not a lot of personal communication, but I felt safe, and I never had any personal animosity, nor did I have much personal, really, communication, except to maybe joke with them, or sometimes I'd try to give them a Coke or a candy bar or something, you know, if I had
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the lack of a mutual language
mm-hmm.
Made it difficult for us to be able to, you know, have much interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had any
okay.
fear.
Okay. How much contact did you have with home?
None.
Really?
Yeah. I probably got a letter from somebody, you know,
mm-hmm.
once or twice a week, but I very seldom wrote home.
Why was that?
Oh, I guess it's too busy. I never thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
It never bothered me. Our family's real close and real large, and I don't know, pretty soon it's Monday and then it's Friday, or, I mean, you don't care what
mm-hmm.
day it is, or every day is the same, but
mm-hmm.
it's just 5 days later, and so you just didn't write something, and yeah, I thought about that since then a lot,
mm-hmm.
As to what my mother and father were going through when they saw every day on television all the fighting and airplanes and everybody doing it. And I mean, if my son were over there right now, I would want a communication every day.
Right.
And now you can by email or
mm-hmm.
by voicemail, or but somehow or another there's a way to communicate, but back there was no communication except for what they called MARS,
mm-hmm.
which was some sort of a radio telephone thing, but you had to, I don't know, it was just, you had to sign up, you had to wait. I don't know, anyway, it was not, I never did that.
Hmm.
So,
do you regret that today?
I regret not communicating more, because now I know what my parents must have been going
mm-hmm.
through. Because I was unmarried, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't have any responsibilities in that respect, no family,
mm-hmm.
but very close, strong, extended minority Mexican family, Catholic family that did everything together and all that, and
mm-hmm.
so I just didn't feel like there was any big deal. I mean, I just liked going to school or something. So
right.
it was, but now that I think back on it, I should have communicated more, because I would think that they would probably have been worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
But. I didn't realize until I became a parent
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
that would have been something that would have been pretty much lacking, a big lacking on my part.
Let me take a break for a moment and change out this disc.
Sure.
Can you tell me, sir, let me ask about entertainment. And you talk about what you would do when you came off the flight line, when you finished your missions, and you would come back and you had some everybody had a bar set up and you had clubs. What would you all do for entertainment?
Well, it was mainly the entertainment was ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The crews would stick together after the missions, and you would go into country with a crew, and you would stay with that same crew the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd come back out with that crew. And so I would say 80 to 90% of our interaction with other people was with our own crew. Obviously, there's other crews there, too, but you may or may not know some of them, and they may have different schedules, and
mm-hmm.
so you don't see them and that sort of thing. But then there was occasionally they would have entertainment at some of the bigger bases.
Mm-hmm.
They would have Korean or Vietnamese or Philippine or Japanese bands
mm-hmm.
that would come in and play
mm-hmm.
For a couple hours or something at one of the officers' clubs. Or one of the just whatever clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always a big treat. And then there was the USO thing with Bob Hope that came over.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal, too. So,
did you get to see that?
I missed it. I was there,
mm-hmm.
but it was an off time for me. And our crew was flying, and
okay.
so we missed it. But,
Yes,
I was there. I was around it, but I just didn't get to see it firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to a lot of people that were very appreciative that he did that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he came more than once, I believe.
Yes, sir.
But he was a great morale booster to have
mm-hmm.
somebody like that take their time and trouble come over and
mm-hmm.
do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the entertainment was basically self-made,
mm-hmm.
and there was a lot of card playing, a lot of dice playing, there was a lot
mm-hmm.
of gambling, there was gambling, although gambling doesn't mean the same thing now as it did then, because back there it was only play money. I mean, you didn't have any money, there was nothing to spend money on, so
mm-hmm.
it didn't make any difference. It was not like you were losing $100, it was just Monopoly money or whatever
right.
you want to call it, and so
right.
nobody put much emphasis on
mm-hmm.
money,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people did gamble just for fun.
Mm-hmm. What about any alcohol or drug use that you witnessed?
I witnessed a lot of alcohol. Everybody drank,
mm-hmm.
Everybody drank to excess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there was a lot of drugs there, but I didn't. I'm positive there was,
mm-hmm.
but for the cruise that I was there 2 years, the cruise that I was on, if there were anybody that was doing any drugs,
mm-hmm.
any drugs, whether it be marijuana or anything stronger than that,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know about it. I just and it's not because I'm dumb.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think I just. I'm sure it was there, and I'm sure it was going on. I guess. But it wasn't so much with the crews, and I don't know why. I guess maybe it was because we had all the alcohol we wanted, or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the reason is. But if the guys that were in the bush, I mean, I've talked to a lot of guys that were in the Army that were in the bush,
mm-hmm.
and there's no doubt there was a lot of, you know, marijuana availability,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of smoking and all that, I guess. It never got to the cruise, and I guess part of that might have been because where we stayed was never in the little places.
Mm-hmm.
Where we stayed was Tonsonute or Cameron Bay or Da Nang, and we were very well, you know, protected and insulated and isolated, and so we didn't have the contact to go out and buy something from somebody or whatever. It's just we were always together.
Right.
So alcohol use was huge.
Okay.
I mean, you couldn't drink. You couldn't drink a dollar because, I mean, drinks were a dime, and the doubles were happy hours for a dime.
Wow.
So if you put a dollar on the bar, I mean, that would be 10 double drinks. And, I mean, you can't even drink that much. So,
right.
So it was free, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they encouraged, I think they encouraged alcohol drinking, and I think they encouraged smoking. they gave you cigarettes with your meals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, you open up your, what they call an MRE,
mm-hmm.
and there would be your meal and your napkin and plastic fork and a pack of cigarettes. So.
Did you smoke over there?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. Almost everybody, but almost everybody smoked, mm-hmm. or at least seemed like to me, and they didn't have any rules against smoking. I mean, you could smoke in the airplane,
right?
While you're flying,
right?
Whereas now you can't at all. But
right. What about music? What role did music play over there for you? And what songs come back to your mind?
Yeah, well, those same ones that everybody probably lives is, we got to get out of this place, and Yellow River, but mm-hmm. the way they would sing that, the Oriental bands, they couldn't pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
So they would say Yellow River, River, and so it got to be a joke that the way they couldn't pronounce their L's,
mm-hmm.
or at least let's say if they don't pronounce them the same way we do, they use them as R's instead of L's. But the songs that were popular before you went over there were the tendency, the ones to be popular with you
mm-hmm.
while you were there, because you didn't hear the new ones.
Mm-hmm.
They had Armed Forces Radio, and I think they had a partial Armed Forces TV, but you were never around one hardly
right.
Much. So I think they did have that Armed Forces Radio, because we could pick that up in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they have part of that in whatever, the Good Morning Vietnam, that
mm-hmm.
movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of that was fairly realistic.
Okay. Were you able to keep up with news from back in the United States?
No.
Did you have a desire to?
No, not really. Not because I was trying to shut it off or anything. It's just, if you're busy, and I guess we did get once a week, maybe it was twice a week, once a week we got what's called Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
which was I think it was once or twice a week. Anyway, it was about all that we needed. I mean, it would say some of the stuff that's going on back in the States. Yeah, whatever's going on, a presidential election or whatever. But certainly nothing of the minute. And something could happen, and you'd be 3 or 4 days later before you found out about it. I mean,
right.
Just because, I could say, not because you're avoiding it. It's just, you're too busy flying and sleeping and drinking and getting ready to do the same thing the next day
mm-hmm.
to really be too concerned about it.
Did you have any R&Rs?
No, we weren't. We had a lot of trips that were
mm-hmm.
ended up being kind of R&Rs, where you end up with a couple days off in Hong Kong or Bangkok or Tokyo or wherever, and so you'd get a couple days off. But the crews did not get R&R, and it's kind of a technical reason. Because we were not stationed inside of Vietnam. We were stationed outside of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and then we would go to Vietnam for 28 days, come back out for 2 or 3 days, and go
mm-hmm.
back in for 28 days. Well, the R&R was set up for people that were stationed in country.
Mm-hmm.
So the Army mostly,
mm-hmm.
they would go for 6 months, and then they would get, I think it was a week R&R,
mm-hmm.
and then they come back for 6 months. Well, we didn't have that stress or strain of being there for 6 months
mm-hmm.
in a row.
Right.
We would go for 28 days, and then we'd come back out for 2 or 3 days. And
mm-hmm.
so anyway, they didn't extend that R&R to people that were not stationed inside of Vietnam, what they call PCS.
Right. I was wondering if they did actually give you an official time off, but you were able to take it when you could get it, I guess.
Right, right. And they'd put a little fluff in there, or if the airplane would break, I mean, or need some maintenance or something,
mm-hmm.
and the next thing, you get an extra day off. And what.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a lot of thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, about having days off or not having days off. I mean, it didn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
You just you flew, and they expected to fly every day, and then once in a while they would, you look down and you wouldn't be on their schedule, and so that just meant you just slept later and drank more and had fun. And, you know, a lot of times we'd go to the gym, work out, or play basketball or handball, or go to the beach, all those things. But it never was highly counted on as, oh boy, this is 4 days and I can't wait to get the next day. I mean, it was just whatever happened, it happened, and nobody really was okay. It was fine. So
you mentioned that you came from a Catholic family, is that correct?
Right.
Were your religious beliefs affected by your service in Vietnam or in the area in Southeast Asia?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember exactly, but it seems to me that I stayed with the Catholic Church even through that era, although you never knew what day it was and didn't count or whatever. And they told us when you're in combat, though, you don't have to go to Mass every Sunday and that sort of thing. But I think it was probably afterwards I kind of drifted away, and then in the last 10 years I've come all the way back. So it's sort of like, no, I don't think it affected me. I mean, I don't think the religion affected me, or nor did the place and the war affect my religion. I think it just kind of made it stronger, I think, in a lot of respects, that you felt like, you know, everything was going to be okay because, you know, your religion's there to back you up, just like your family is, or just like all the things that you use to anchor yourself. And that's a good foundation.
Okay.
So that was a good foundation for me.
Okay. Did you ever witness any racial issues?
Nothing that I can, I mean, nobody shot anybody, I mean, not in front of me, but there was a fairly strong binding of the African-American, the black military with other black military and white, not as strongly binding with other whites, but and not very much binding between the two. There was like there were two separate bodies doing the same thing, but not really, I mean, together, but not really personally, closely aligned.
Right.
So, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, jokes and epithets, all kinds of things going back and forth, but nothing that I ever saw, like eight black guys go up and beat one white guy up, or one white guy, or eight white guys go beat up one black guy, and shoot each other, or whatever. But it certainly was a factor. I mean, back then they all had that. I mean, the blacks had they had a pretty close relationship with each other, and they had a lot of signs and signals and handshakes and movements and whatever that the whites weren't really let in on. And so that was kind of my first exposure to large groups not interacting closely.
Did it affect the missions or the service that you had to perform every day?
No, it didn't. I've never seen it.
Okay.
So, they may have, and I didn't know about it, if somebody was, you know, didn't show up or was trying to, you know, do something bad and I didn't know about it or whatever, but... It never affected. I never said, "Well, we can't fly this mission. We got a black guy on our crew," or I've never had anybody come up to me and say, "Oh, I'm not going to salute you, Lieutenant, because you're white," or whatever.
Okay. What would you say was the most humorous event that you remember from your time?
Wow. Well, I mean, there were, you know, there were humorous events every day, I guess, because everybody was pretty footloose and fancy-free and having a pretty good time, you know, physically in good shape and mentally and emotionally in good shape. And but I can't remember one humorous event or incident. And not because there wasn't any, it's just because I... there's probably so many. I mean, it just every day was fine. And I bet you if I really sat down and thought about it, that somebody fell off a bar stool or did something funny like that, I guess. But I think one of the funnest things or that woke my eyes up a little bit, I don't know if I said that, but when I first went into country, that I was at the officers' club, and this colonel and this other lieutenant got drunk, and they were going to see who's going to, I think I told you about that, they were going to see who's going to swim out the furthest, and they did that, and they almost got killed, and then they almost drowned, and then they know it, either one of them wanted to give up to each other. I guess that really wasn't a humorous thing, but it really struck me as to why they would expose themselves to that kind of danger just to prove that they're, I guess, a man or whatever, but which I think is fine. I mean, I just think that's fine to do, but it seems like there ought to be a different way to do that other than, you know, really, because, I mean, that's for keeps, and you're out there in the bay. I mean, there's sharks and people with guns, and you're drunk anyway, and then now you're swimming, and there's no lights, and there's nobody to pick you up if you get in trouble, and nobody. I mean, it's just, I just thought, wow, these guys are something else. But no, I didn't even consider it necessarily humorous, although I guess I thought it was kind of humorous that nobody else thought it was a big deal.
Right.
That they did this. It was like, well, you know, somebody else did it last night, and somebody else will do it tomorrow, and it's my turn tonight.
Is there a particular brave action that comes to mind that you remember?
No, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of them. I mean, but I think it was all comes, it's encompassing with doing the job. I mean, they, what they ingrained upon you is that you had a mission to perform, and that was above each and every individual, and the goal was more important than the means of getting there, and so whatever you had to do, you had to accomplish the mission. And so I don't know if it was bravery as much as it was that people were ingrained to do it, and a lot of people got shot at, and I mean, we got shot at, and airplanes got shot at, people got, with, you know, there's lots of things that, you know, occurred that the exposure was there, and some people didn't make it, you know, some people did get hit, but the odds, the percentage of odds of you getting even shot at were fairly slim, but even if they got shot at, it was slim again that you'd get hit, and if you got hit, it was slim again that it would knock you down. So if you consider having an airplane with full of Class A coming down through small arms fire, landing in the middle of the jungle without any escort, as being, I don't know, brave or whatever, then we did that a lot. But it was not because we sat back there and thought, well, let's be brave today. We just, that was the mission. So you just, you didn't think, well, should I or shouldn't I? You just thought, what's the best way for me to do that? What's the going to be the most effective or efficient way to make sure that I get whatever I've got in my airplane down there on the ground?
Right.
And delivered. And so I don't think anybody's, I mean, that I personally, that I know of, felt like they were doing anything brave except that they were accomplishing what they were told to do.
Now, when did you actually leave CCK?
I was there from, I think I want to say January of 69 to December of 70. Well, I was there 23 months.
Okay.
Almost 2 years.
Right. And then you went to Woodbridge, England, is that correct?
Right, yeah. With some training in between.
Right. I was going to say, you got a chance to go back to the United States and
yeah.
Some time off to your family,
mm-hmm.
everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
When you did leave, what were your feelings about leaving the theater and leaving that war behind you?
I was disappointed, actually. I think I would have liked to have stayed more.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it was just because it was easy times. It was fun times,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have any responsibility. I didn't have any kids. I wasn't married. Had my own airplane flying all over the world, and they were paying me to do it. And you know, there were times when it was, you know, a little bit whatever, stressful physically,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. But basically, it was just a lot of fun for a pilot to
mm-hmm.
have those kinds of missions and go to those kinds of places.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people extended. I extended and stayed an extra whatever months. And,
mm-hmm.
and then I kind of tried to do it again, but then they put out the word, well, we're not going to extend anybody anymore. People are staying too long.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the only disappointment, I guess. I didn't have any ill feelings or any feelings that, you know, we lost the war or that I wish I would have done a better job or,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't have any, they told me to leave, so that's what I did.
Right. What kind of reception did you receive back home in the United States?
Bad.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a typical thing. I mean, I heard it lately. I didn't hear it a while back, but
mm-hmm.
But yeah, you didn't. You know, after a couple, three times of fighting your ways out of the bars back here because you were a pilot in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
You certainly learned not to talk about that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you would say, you know, I was at school or I was in Europe or whatever. You would never tell anybody, oh, yeah, I was a pilot, just got back to Vietnam, because that would be a certain argument. I mean, certainly arguments, but
mm-hmm.
not more. So,
now, was this with everybody in general, or would you talk about it with your family and friends?
Well, I don't think I talked about it so much with my family and friends, because it just wasn't a topic of conversation, but I'm talking about if you just go out in a bar and,
right.
and somebody might introduce you to somebody, and they say, okay, what do you do, or whatever, and it's used to say, well, I was a pilot in the Air Force. I am a pilot in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, you don't say that. I mean, you may say, well, I'm in the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you been or what are you doing or whatever. You'd say, well, I'm away to Europe and I've been to Texas or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't worth it.
Okay.
So I think that happened to almost everybody.
Was there a time period or a time in your life when that changed, when you felt comfortable talking about your experience in Southeast Asia?
Well, I think so. I think it certainly wasn't then, and it certainly, you know, it was probably after I got out of the military,
mm-hmm.
that I think people just kind of forgot about stuff, and so nobody cared that much about somebody being over there or not being over there.
Mm-hmm.
New generations and people don't know the arguments or the issues, and so, yeah, I think that after a while it got to the point where now I kind of think of it as a badge of honor, as a,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to a detriment. I mean, I never did think of it as a detriment. I just thought that everybody else's perception was that
right.
it was a detriment,
right.
so I just didn't talk about it. But although I was never ashamed of it personally,
mm-hmm.
I just did what I was, you know, trained to do,
right.
supposed to do.
How much did you follow the war when you came home? I mean, it was winding down for the United States, obviously.
Yeah, it was, and I lost track of it completely.
Did you really?
Yeah, because I went to England, and,
mm-hmm.
and the only time I remember was when a guy came as a navigator from the old squadron I was in, was behind me by about 6 months or a year,
mm-hmm.
and I casually met him, briefly met him while I was there. He was just getting there when I was, well, within a month of leaving. But anyway, so he came to the new squadron where I was in England, and he told me, Marty, you wouldn't believe it. Some of those crews won't fly those missions anymore. I said, what? He said, well, yeah, they won't, because they're knocking them down. They're knocking all these airplanes down. So the crews are saying, we want fighter cover, or we want new tactics, or we want, I mean, I can't, the crews don't want to fly. I mean, they don't want to fly the missions. And I was going, I never even know that was an option. I didn't know that you, I mean, it's like people told me afterwards, somebody went to Canada. Well, I didn't even know that there was an option of going to Canada.
Right.
So, in any event, I remember that. So that was the first time I heard about the war, probably in 6 months. I mean, to know anything about it, was that kind of brought it home that it's really hot now. And for a crew to walk up to some major lieutenant colonel or whoever it is, and it's not because it's that person, it's because it's the rank, but and to say, well, I don't think we want to fly this mission today the way it's written out here. We're too exposed. I just never it occurred to me. So anyway, that was my next contact with the war.
And this is even when you're still in the service and you're around the military every day. And there still was no discussion about it. And or little discussion about it and, and little news about it. Do you remember how you felt when the United States pulled out in 73?
You know, that kind of snuck up on me. I think I heard about that. It's kind of fuzzy. I'm not really sure how I found out about that. But I guess I just didn't quite get it or didn't believe it or didn't know it or something. I guess I felt a little bit disappointed that evidently people were saying that we didn't win the war or that we lost the war, and I guess that was probably a feeling, you know, as an Air Force pilot, you would get that you would, you know, prefer not to lose the war if you could help it.
Of course, right.
And then somebody told me afterwards that we lost the war, so I didn't know.
Okay. Our time is up for today. Why don't we take a break?
Okay.
This is Dr. Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore. Today is September 4th, 2003. It's a little after 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Montemore is in Kansas City, Missouri. Sir, why don't we pick up where we left off? You had come home from Southeast Asia, and we were discussing some of the incidents that happened to you and some of your experiences. I asked about how much you kept up with the war effort in Vietnam was one of the things. And can you describe kind of overall U.S. policy after you left and what you thought of, say, the Vietnamization policy and things of that sort?
You know, I was fairly isolated from that because I was still in the military, but I was stationed, I went from Vietnam and I was stationed in England.
Right.
And so I don't recall a lot of coverage of the Vietnam War in the English press, and we really didn't get any direct, like they would now, I mean direct news from the United States or something like that on a routine, regular basis. I heard of the terms. I understood what they were attempting to do from a distance. I did not have, I guess, direct access to what the specific policies, how they were implemented or anything else. But, yes, my belief is that they tried to distance themselves from the conflict by inserting the military and decision makers in Vietnam and the actual combat and flights try to turn them over more to the Vietnamese, so that I guess the goal was to distance themselves gradually so that they could gradually withdraw and leave it up to their own people to finish the job. But I'm not an expert on that or anything else, but that's what I heard. I from what I could see, it did not appear to me that they would be successful in attempting to the victor in the military part with the personnel, the amount, and lack of sophistication of the Vietnamese. I mean, I think that they just kind of sat back and let us fight the war, and then when we started trying to train them in jet fighters and to try to resupply, to try to do the things that all the American troops were doing, whether it be in the ground or in the air, I mean, it was pretty evident that that would not work.
Right. What was the discussion and the mood in England about the Vietnam War? Did you get any sense at all what the British public or some of the British military thought about the war?
You know, I think this is just an impression more than a specific recollection of a specific comment, but it appeared to me that the British people were supportive. Supportive of the president, supportive of the war, and supportive of the military, probably more than the Americans were, because the Americans obviously were involved in doing whatever demonstrations and other acts that would show their displeasure with the continuing of the war, whereas the British were not involved. They didn't have any troops there. They didn't have any input. They didn't have any expense, and they didn't have any exposure. So I think that the British were still and have been basking in the World War II effort by America, and I think that just anything American at that time was okay with them. And I felt like I was very well accepted by the British people, by the English people. Whether I was wearing my uniform on the way home from the base and was filling up my gas tank, or just generally out on the economy, it's not really difficult to judge or to see and conclude that a person is American military when you're running around in kind of American clothes and you've got a short haircut, and I mean, you kind of stand out. So.
Right.
I never had, except one time, never had any incident that I would consider to be rude or off color because I was an American or American military. So I think they were generally supportive and they never voiced any descending comments to me whatsoever about where I was or what I did or anything else.
What was that negative experience?
Well, it had more to do with, I think it's just, I mean, there's rude people in New York City and in Kansas City and Lubbock and wherever, but it was a reference to getting on a train, and there was an older gentleman there, I was with an American girl. And we were about to sit down in a train compartment, and he made the comment something like, "Well, if you're going to be here, I don't want to be around any American people," or something to that effect. And kind of got up and actually, I think I turned around and said, "Well, never mind," and I just walked out.
Okay.
And went somewhere else.
Okay.
But it's obvious he either had a bad experience himself, or someone in his family, or something was. It was the obviousness that I was an American, and he even commented that he did not appreciate me. So.
Okay.
That's all.
Do you remember? Okay. Do you remember how you felt in April 1975 when Saigon fell and South Vietnam fell?
Well, I think I don't know that I knew it at the time, at the exact time. It might have been a day or two later or whatever. But I think I was pretty disbelieving. I don't think I could believe that we actually militarily could be thrown out of the country. I thought we could be. I thought we could make the political decision or the military decision to leave voluntarily. But I was pretty shocked. To at least the comments or the commentaries I heard was that it was a military, takeover of Saigon. And I'd been to Saigon many times, and it was relatively safe, and in the sense that you didn't have to worry about troops that were going to come through the city and that sort of thing. And it just made me feel real funny as part of a bigger team that could be defeated, or at least it appeared. I mean, it appeared that militarily we were, with what was left, although we were retreating, not retreating, but withdrawing anyway, it still seemed funny that we were forced to withdraw at their timetable rather than at ours, and that was, you know, basically accomplished militarily.
You retired from the Air Force in 1975, correct?
Yeah. No, I went out of the active duty Air Force, and I went to law school until 1978. I graduated in 1978, and then I joined the Missouri Air National Guard as a C-130 pilot in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Okay.
So then I retired from there in 1995 after another, whatever that would be, let's see.
16 years.
Yeah, 16 years plus the 8.5 or 9 that I had. So I was right around 27 years, somewhere in there.
I'm asking because my next question is about your opinion of the media coverage of the war. But you were in England after you finished your tour in Southeast Asia. Did you ever get a chance, really, to view how the media was covering the Vietnam War?
No. I probably did. I'm sure I did. In the transition period from Vietnam to England, I had about a 3 or 4 month interim retraining on a slightly different aircraft down in Florida. It was not my focus to attempt to try to follow the war, but when I, you know, obviously couldn't get away from it because it was on the news every night. It appeared to me, yes, that it was getting to be pretty, you know, I thought, I guess, one-sided and maybe not very flattering, and it seemed that it was, you know, maybe misconstruing some facts or was emphasizing the negative. And there was a lot of coverage. There was a lot of coverage of the war from the... Not from the military standpoint in Vietnam, but from the protest standpoint in the United States.
More of that.
Yeah, more of that.
Okay. How much did you talk about it with your family when you came in before you transitioned over to England?
I didn't have a lot of time back here, and I think most of the time that I spent back here was probably more social with other friends and that sort of thing, and I don't believe that I ever got any kind of political or military discussion with my my family with regard to it, and I really never did address it with anybody else either, actually.
Okay. When you look back today on your service in Vietnam, in the war, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about your service in the Vietnam War today?
I feel pretty good about it. I mean, I feel, real good about it. To me, I was in the right place at the right time to become a pilot. I was proud to be trained. I was proud to be part of that team and to go to a foreign country on the orders and the behest of others and for the United States or whatever. I felt like... I was happy to go then, and I'm happy now that I went, and I'm proud of my service back there.
Okay.
I mean, and there's lots of others. I'm just saying.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, either do or don't, but I'm saying it's not like I was there by myself or whatever.
Of course.
Hundreds of thousands of people there, so it's, you know. But, okay. I feel very good about that. In fact, I think probably before, 20 years ago, I never even mentioned that I went. Now, if anybody asks me where I went, that's probably one of the main things I say, is that, I spent a couple of years in Vietnam flying, you know, aircraft there.
Why the shift? Why the change?
Well, I think the American public has changed. The American public opinion has changed in the last 15 or 20 years because of the other wars that we've had. And some people wanted to protest those wars, but they did and do make a distinction between protesting against the war and protesting against the military. That they're separate.
Right. So it's easier to talk about it. It's more accepted to discuss such a war, a traumatic event for the United States now versus then.
Yeah, I think the attitude back then was, that's an unjust war. How could you go? Whereas if somebody feels like it's an unjust war, they'll say, we support our troops even though it's an unjust war.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really the troops' decision to go or not go or whatever.
Right. Okay.
You're told you do what you're told. So.
Mm-hmm. For yourself personally, individually, have you ever suffered any PTSD incidents or any other kind of disabilities from your service?
I don't know. I mean, everybody has problems, and so I do have. I don't have flashbacks, but I do have, recollections of loud noises and lots of activity and lots of bombs going off and then lots of fire and that sort of thing. So I have a physical reaction to loud noises, like around the 4th of July or a car backfiring or whatever. But a lot of people have that.
Right.
I would guess. I mean, a lot of people jump, and I jump. And so it doesn't keep me up at night. I don't go to a psychologist or psychiatrist for anything. But, I would say probably nothing specific other than startling loud noises startle me.
Okay.
Sort of thing, so.
If you could change anything about your time in Southeast Asia, what would it be?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't know. I flew the airplane I wanted to fly. Had the mission I wanted to fly. Went to the places I wanted to go to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm proud that I went. I'm glad that I went. It was a good experience, and I made it through it. And I'm sure there must be something individually. Maybe I could have slept a little bit longer, or some morning, or had better breakfast or something. I mean, what I mean is I know I have no major, nothing that I can think of that I would, I would change about anything. I guess I would probably, if I could have, I probably would have tried to maybe get more into the culture and the history of that entire region, including Thailand and Vietnam and the places that I visited, which was a lot of places, but I didn't spend a lot of time on that part of it. It was more the social aspect of just enjoying your time off by drinking and partying or whatever. So, no, I think that's probably the only thing I would change.
Okay.
Or do differently if I had my after thoughts before, then I probably would have done some more of that.
What was the most significant thing that you learned individually while you were there?
I guess there's a couple things. That war is real, and that people don't come back from war. And it's not a football game that, you can play next week if you lose. Or you always have next year or whatever. The reality that you know, people get hurt and killed, and they don't come home, or they come home in a box, and
mm-hmm.
that's the end of their book. I mean, it's not the another chapter to be written or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
People were permanently disabled, and that permanent disability stays with them. I think that I was pretty much immortal and oblivious to the consequences of military action,
mm-hmm.
Whether it be intentional by the other side or even just accident. I mean, I'm sure there was thousands and thousands of people that got hurt or died because of their own accident or the accident of another fellow American.
Mm-hmm.
But that the result is the same, and if it doesn't matter, it's still permanent. So from a philosophical standpoint, I think that I probably recognized parts of that while I was there, and then I certainly recognized it afterwards, later, that, wow, that must have been a scary experience for a mother and a father to have their child flying, or to have their son flying over there in combat for a couple of years and not hear very often.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reality of that, where I did not communicate with my parents very often, I think is something I learned,
okay.
Especially after I had my own child.
Right.
Other than that, I think I learned that, you know, teamwork, coordination, things can screw up. You got to keep communicating. Just, I don't know, lots of, I guess, lessons of life that are not, you know, so destructive.
Mm-hmm.
Things that you learn just because you're part of a bigger organization, and everybody, you know, learns in one way or the other in some organization or another, and that's where I probably learned mine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How was the war most affected your life in general?
How
has the war most affected your life in general?
Well, since then, I don't know that the war has affected me or affected my life in any negative aspect. I mean, I think from a positive aspect, I think it's not because it's a war, but because I was had those experiences, I think I have a better understanding and a better comprehension of things that most Americans probably have never been exposed to, and
mm-hmm.
you know, never will be, and that's, I guess, that's not good or bad, but it's just an experience that that is not universal,
mm-hmm.
and so I don't think it's negatively affected my life, and I just think it's just an accumulation of experiences that most people will not ever have.
Has it benefited you in your professional career after
you
got out of the service?
Well, it happens to be that I'm doing a lot of aviation law, and I don't know that the war itself has benefited my career, although I tend to be around a lot of other people that are pilots, some of which were military pilots and some of which were not, but
mm-hmm.
they're pilots of just general aviation aircraft, civilian aircraft. And I think all that whole background and history that I have is beneficial to me personally, in the sense that they have a tendency to be more confident in giving cases to somebody that flies airplanes if it's
mm-hmm.
an airplane crash case,
mm-hmm.
which only makes sense. It would be like saying to somebody that, you know, got a medical malpractice case, and this person, you know, has training or is a registered nurse or a doctor or whatever. Well,
mm-hmm.
then obviously they're going to have more information available to them, more experience than somebody that's not.
Right.
So, in that respect, it has.
Okay. As far as the United States in general, what kind of lessons do you think the country learned from its experience in Vietnam?
Well, you know, that's I assume that's a subject of many debates and discussions.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably learned that it's difficult to win a war militarily when the populace do not, at least not maybe the majority, that are not desirous of that change or that or to resist the change that's attempting to be made. I think that from a military pilot standpoint, I think we learn a lot of tactics and a lot of techniques that were a result of bad experiences, but I noticed that in flying 10 or 15 or 20 years later, some of the same aircraft, that we went back to doing some of the things that we did before that were not, that were abandoned in Vietnam, and I guess it was, you know, you got to learn some of those lessons over again, I guess. I don't know, you know, I don't know that I have the observational powers to say from a countrywide standpoint, from a nationwide standpoint, what lessons there are to learn, or that we did learn, except to say I think that it probably, I think it probably has given the nation or a feeling of not being supremely in control of everything at all times. So whatever that means.
Do you think Vietnam is still with the country today, or has it been put to rest?
I think it may be with individuals, but it's not with the country.
Okay. Have you done any reading on Vietnam?
You know, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I've never read a book, nor have I ever seen a movie.
Really?
That had to do with Vietnam.
So that you don't know if that's intentional or not?
Well, I don't. Well, I assume there must be some intent there, but I don't know. I guess I don't know. I don't know. I just never saw one.
Do you go to movies? Do you attend to movies regularly?
No.
Okay.
Not a lot. I mean, of course, there's all kinds of movies you can get and see on you know, cable TV or bring home or whatever you want. And I've never rented one or, you know, gone out of my way to see one or looked for it on cable TV or, you know, any of those movies. I have been places where they've been on. I might look at it for a couple of minutes, but never sit down and watch one. And I think part of it was that when I first heard there were movies about Vietnam that came out, I just thought they'll never get it all and they'll never get it right. They'll never get that in a movie. You know, I mean, that's just too huge. There's no way to... It's like taking a picture of the Grand Canyon, you know. If you've been to the Grand Canyon, you don't want to see a picture of the Grand Canyon because it's just, I mean, it doesn't do it justice. I mean,
right.
It doesn't portray it. So that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. What are your thoughts about Vietnam today?
The country?
Not the war, the country.
Well, I think the country is probably in better esteem and held higher than many other countries in that region. And I don't think that anybody harbor any will against Vietnam or Vietnamese people or anything else. I think that they're probably hard workers and intelligent and all the things that. You know, that you hear, I know it's a beautiful country, and I don't have any, you know, great desires to go visit, although I would certainly not stay away from it. I would just, I think it's a fine country.
So you would not really want to go back to visit?
Well, I think it would be difficult to go back and say, well, this is where we used to do this or used to do that. I think it's probably changed and it's harder. I don't know. I probably would go if that's what say my family wanted to do, but if I had my choice, I'd probably, and it could only go to one place, I may go to Hong Kong or Taiwan or Thailand instead. But if I were going to go to several countries, I would not go because of some unpleasant lingering thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Very, very sporadically. I mean, I think I probably have only when receiving something like a manicure or a haircut or something like that. And then a lot of times there's Vietnamese in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I may talk to them for a couple of minutes after I ask them where they're from and what, you know, how long they've been here or whatever. And if they say Vietnam, I ask them where, and you know, usually I know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
So I just say, well, I've been there too. And that's, it doesn't really get political or military or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, you know, well, that's a beautiful country. And just as topic of conversation.
Okay. What would you tell the younger generation today about the Vietnam War, if you had the opportunity to speak to, say, college-age students?
Well, I guess I'll probably, it would be by way of explanation that the people that were there were them. I mean, it's the same people that they are, and their age and younger, 17, 18, 19 years old, were, you know, out in the jungles, you know, risking their lives every day. And the people that are in college today obviously are in college and they're not in the jungles.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to worry about not coming back from those jungles. And I don't think that the American military worried too much about that, the young kids, just because of their lack of maturity. But the reality does set in sooner or later when you're over there. So I guess by way of explanation that the people that were there because they were of draft age, could not or would not or did not, whatever, go to college, didn't get deferments, or they voluntarily joined, but most of them were drafted, and that's where they were sent. And so I think that the people were there, the vast majority are the same people that are in school today, and have the same, you know, attitudes and likes and dislikes and everything else that they have today. But they were in the wrong place, wrong time, or in the right place, wrong, right time, or whatever you want to call it, so that they ended up becoming involved, and most of the people that became involved, it was not voluntary. So I guess I would just say that the ones that went over there are not any different than you.
Have you ever been to the memorial in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
What have been your experiences there?
Just the I was struck by the by the sanctity, the quietness, the solitude, by the appropriateness of it. I just thought they did just a great job, if you want to call it, of a memorial that I think most Vietnam veterans appreciate more than having a some sort of light show with a revolving disc of music and I'm making it up, but what I'm saying is rather than having the kind of memorial that is extravagant, I think this is very well done but subdued, and sets the mood for what I think most Vietnam people, Vietnam veterans who served, the people that served in Vietnam, I think that's the mood and the attitude that they have about the war is that it was it at the time, but it's, there's a lot of sadness in what happened to others. And that, to me, that memorial exudes that, that attitude, that quietness, that mood. So I was very impressed with it.
Have you been just one time or multiple times?
because I was in the Air Force as a pilot, we'd go to Washington, D.C., once or twice a year, or maybe not that often, maybe once every two or three years, but just every time I went there. I would probably say I've been there multiple times, not 10, but probably mm-hmm. 4 or 5.
Now, did you go by yourself, or did you have somebody with you?
I think most of the time we had our crew with us, our flight crew, because we're all military.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one else in my unit. There was one, I think, that had been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody went to it just like you would go to, I think, to the memorial for Lincoln or Washington or whatever. But it seemed to be an attraction. So I probably, I don't remember ever going by myself. I remember going by myself with my family, with my wife, going one time.
Mm-hmm.
And that just happened to be because we were there on a vacation, and we went there, so I don't remember ever going there by myself, but going with a crew of three or four, or going with my wife is the times I remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But basically, when you get there to that memorial, I think you disconnect from who you are with for the time that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And your thoughts and your attitude and characterizations of the whole experience becomes a solitary one as opposed to a group experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that respect, I guess if you walk up with four or five people, when you're there, you're by yourself, and then when you leave, you're back with four or five people.
Do you think that's unique to that particular memorial?
I think it is. I think it's unique to the people that were there. And to that memorial, I think it's a combination of having been there and realizing that it wasn't all fun and games like you thought it was going to be, and that there was a lot of people that got hurt and killed. And so the realization is from having been there, but the setting for the memorial complements that. I think it brings it out.
Mm-hmm.
And allows it to happen, as opposed to some other kind of memorial that might be gaudy or...
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think it's an excellent memorial.
Okay. Do you think the United States government has taken care of its Vietnam veterans?
I think so. If I were in a different situation, obviously I may have a different opinion, but... I think that people that go and become disabled and that sort of thing are owed something. I think that you can't support them for the rest of their lives or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. But decent medical, if it's service connected.
Mm-hmm.
The GI Bill helped me. I go through law school, or else I wouldn't have been able to go.
Mm-hmm.
So. I have a pleasant experience, but then again, I don't have the unpleasantness of some kind of permanent problem or something that may or may not be taken care of by the
mm-hmm.
VA. And so, I think so. I think the VA itself, or the government, I think, has done fine by the Vietnam veterans.
Okay. Mr. Montemore, is there anything else that you'd like to add or anything else that you'd like to talk about that we have not covered in our series of discussions?
No, it was very thorough. Very thorough. Some of the questions, some of the areas are areas that I've never really thought of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sitting around thinking I wouldn't have thought of those areas. And so I think it's very well done, very professional, and very comprehensive. And so... No, I don't have anything specific or even generally that we haven't discussed.
Okay. Well, very good. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
And
this will conclude our oral history interview with Mr. Martin Montemore.